Hey, you guys, movie retrospective time.
Yeah, this is a good one.
Talking about a classic.
Yep.
This time around, Apocalypse Now.
Probably one of the best movies ever made. Written by John Milius.
Yeah, I don't think anyone would argue with you on that score.
Yeah, written by John Milius and directed by Francis Ford Coppola. It's definitely the best Vietnam War movie.
Oh, easily.
I wouldn't say it was totally accurate. But in certain ways, spiritually, it was very accurate. The meaning behind it was pretty accurate. Not everything you see in the movie, like for instance, Milius said that a lot of the stuff that you see in the movie is not things that troops actually did. It was stuff that they kind of wanted to do or wished they could have done. Like for instance, water skiing behind the patrol boat.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That would be something you'd want to do. But you really couldn't get away with that. You know, if you go back and look at actual films of the missions and photographs and everything, the Army and the Navy in theater was usually wired pretty tight and following pretty tight rules. They did have some slip-ups here or there, but they're telling the reason why you're seeing all this stuff is because they're telling the story of Heart of Darkness, but what would happen if that was in Vietnam?
Yeah, pretty much.
So it's based around another story. And Milius, he was friends with veterans of this war. Milius himself wanted to join. He wanted to go to Vietnam, but he couldn't because he had asthma. He wanted to be a pilot. He wanted to be a Navy pilot. He also kind of wanted to go in the infantry, too. A lot of his friends were in the infantry.
I thought he wanted to join the Marines. I thought he said he joined the Marines. Well,
okay, he might have been talking about a Marine pilot. He was talking about landing on aircraft carriers.
Yeah.
So it may have been a Marine pilot. All right. But, yeah, and a lot of guys that worked on this movie were Special Forces veterans and Vietnam veterans. So it is kind of an informed movie, but they're telling another story that originally didn't happen in Vietnam. It was from a book called Heart of Darkness. Philosophically, the movie's a masterpiece.
Yes.
There's a lot of stuff in the movie that has other meanings or has spiritual meanings. It's very much kind of an Eastern philosophy-based movie in the same way that Conan was. A lot of stuff that happens in this movie also happens in Conan. Willard is kind of the Conan figure of this story. And Colonel Kurtz is basically Thulsa Doom. It's just a different interpretation of Thulsa Doom if you know those movies. But it's kind of retold in the form of Heart of Darkness, which, you know, maybe you might want to get into that part of it.
Yeah, so where the kind of kernel for this came from, John Milius, obviously, who also wrote Conan, and, you know, he wrote Red Dawn.
Red Dawn.
Like a bunch of other movies.
I think Dirty Harry, too.
Yeah, I think he did the first two Dirty Harry movies, if I remember it correctly. So he was still a film student.
Forgot to mention though, we always forget this one, Jeremiah Johnson.
Yeah, that's right.
He wrote that too. And there's a lot of Jeremiah Johnson in Apocalypse Now too. A lot of the same kind of things about surviving in the wild and becoming part of the wild, and becoming a wild animal. That's really what Johnson was. But then you find humanity in being a wild animal, and honor in it. That's but didn't mean to interrupt, but I had to throw in Jeremiah Johnson because everybody forgets that one.
Yeah.
Because it was like so early on, you know.
Yeah. So he was still a student, and as you mentioned, he actually had wanted to go to Vietnam, but they wouldn't let him because he had asthma. And he says that he became intrigued by one of his professors saying that, you know, nobody's done a good adaptation of Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. And so he kind of took that as a challenge. And he decided he was going to take the story, which was originally written in 1899, and transpose it to the Vietnam War, but stay with the same kind of themes.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing, too, I was reading an interview with him. I think it was with Empire Magazine from a few years ago. And he said that he had read Heart of Darkness in school, which I did as well. And he said when he decided to do like a Vietnam-specific version of it, he almost was like, oh, I got to read the book again. And then he's like, you know what? I'm not gonna. I'm not going to read the book again because I want it to be like Heart of Darkness as if I had dreamed it and it was set in Vietnam. And it's interesting because he actually did remember like a great deal of the story. If you don't know, Heart of Darkness is actually set. It's not even, it doesn't have anything to do with the military, really. It just has to do with a bunch of dudes who work for a company that, you know, that does ivory. And it's basically a dude and a crew like going upriver on the Congo looking for this dude, Kurtz, who's kind of like, you know, this big ivory trader, but who has gone native and has, you know, gone savage and has kind of like all these tribal people like that sort of see him as a demigod. So the fact that Milius remembered that much of the story that he was able to transpose it, because yes, Apocalypse Now is a lot different than Heart of Darkness, but not by much. I mean, it's really kind of
the same meaning.
It's the same meaning. And yeah. And honestly, I think another thing that Milius said too that I thought was really interesting was that both Heart of Darkness and Apocalypse Now are essentially sort of like the classic descent into the underworld story, like the Odyssey or Dante's Inferno or something like that. I think John Milius even said he compared the character of Colonel Kilgore, Lieutenant Colonel Kilgore, in the movie to the Cyclops and the Playboy bunnies to the Sirens. And, you know, he's like the one scene toward the end where they're kind of going through like that bridge, like right before they get to Kurtz's compound or whatever. And all those soldiers are in the water, like swimming toward them, like, you know, save us, take us with you and all this other kind of stuff. He took that like specifically from Dante's Inferno. That's that imagery. Now, the interesting thing, though, was that even though John Milius did write the screenplay, Francis Ford Coppola changed it a lot from the original and really kind of flew by the seat of his pants. He was kind of almost making it up as he went along. Like, he had the screenplay, but he changed a bunch of shit. I've seen some stuff that said that really only 20% of Milius's screenplay was left in the final movie because so much of it was Coppola, like, rewriting it.
Yeah.
And very famously, he was just kind of... I mean, if you see, and I kind of want to get into this in a little bit, but if you see, there was a documentary that came out in the 90s called Hearts of Darkness, A Filmmaker's Apocalypse. This... I can't even believe that this movie came out, the masterpiece that it came out, because filming it was a cluster... Fuck.
Yeah.
The world's biggest filmmaking clusterfuck.
But I must mention that, maybe only 20% of Milius's script was in there, but Milius totally approved of the two major edits that were done, which was the theatrical release and then the Redux edit. He liked them both. He said that was it. That's what he was talking about. It had a lot of the elements that he was talking about in it.
Did you know that they did a final cut in 2019?
No, I'd like to see that.
And released it. It's basically the same as Redux, except with 20 minutes taken out of it.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
I know what it is then. Because Milius said the scene where they hook up with the Playboy bunnies and trade for the fuel to get some ass.
Yeah.
He said, really, he didn't like that being in there.
Yeah.
Because it kind of foiled what he wanted those images to be, which they were supposed to be the Sirens, and the Sirens were unattainable.
Yeah.
He said that guys that he knew in Vietnam that were there, that went through USO shows, and of course, I went to USO shows too. When you had these USO shows, it was just girls dancing and bands, and you were happy to see girls from home. That's all it was. The idea of bum rushing the show, that didn't actually happen in reality. And most of the guys that were there, according to Milius, that didn't really cross their minds too much. But then after it was over, it was like, well, what if we just ran up there and grabbed those girls? So Milius put that in there. Milius put a lot of stuff of, what if we just did that? What if I actually just said, fuck it, and decided to surf? Or fuck it, I'm going to go ahead and... So it's kind of an element of fantasy. You know, I'm going to ski behind the patrol boat.
Yeah.
They would never allow you to do that. This shit was too dangerous, you know. Now, the surfing element, all that shit makes sense when you hear what Milius was talking about. Remember the Charlie Don't Surf thing?
Yeah.
A lot of that had to do with Ariel Sharon. Okay. During the Arab-Israeli War, I believe is what it was called. What the Israel invaded Egypt and whipped ass on a bunch of Egyptian tanks, and Ariel Sharon went down by the river and started skewing some fish and was looking at the guys that were with him and says, "We're eating their fish."
Yeah.
And that's
they
where
even
all
mentioned
the,
that on the Wikipedia
yeah,
page.
Yeah, we're
this
eating
movie,
we're
actually.
Eating their fish. We took that shit. Well, that Kilgore was kind of in a way based on Ariel Sharon, you know. We're surfing their waves. You know,
yeah.
That's where a lot of that stuff comes from. It's you're going to see a lot of different interpretations of what all this stuff means and how you're supposed to feel about it. When you understand John Milius, he'll straight up tell you, he is very warlike. He doesn't try to moralize war or say it's a good thing. He's just saying it's a transformative experience. And that it's kind of like a rite of passage, part of personal development, and you're supposed to conquer it and get beyond it. He's very much into Nietzsche's philosophy, which is very kind of Eastern. It's a German interpretation of Eastern philosophy. That good and evil are a single act, in a way. That creation and destruction are a single act. It's yin and yang. And which is, in a way, when you kind of think about it, it's almost kind of sadomasochistic. You don't know pleasure until you understand pain. That's kind of the main thing, you know. You don't know peace until you know war. You're supposed to get beyond it. And that's and the story's written in that way. It's not really an anti-war story in the way that you would think it was, but it was kind of an anti-Vietnam conflict story because it was kind of corrupt and it wasn't pure. It was a fake conflict that was very civilized. When you strip away the civilization off of it, what it really should have been is something primal, a tribal struggle between tribes, and that's what Kurt was fighting. And it was unacceptable to the, I guess you could say, the white man's army. All that's in there.
Yeah, that definitely is in
there. That's it. And Milius is kind of condemning Western corporate warfare. That their heart is not in it, and it's just
well,
about...
Well, that it's dishonest.
It's dishonest. It's about kickbacks. You got guys in Washington, you elected the leaders in Washington getting kickbacks from corporations because they gave them the contracts that fuel these things, and then the army's in on it at the Pentagon level because, of course, you now there's a chance for advancement up through the ranks and bonuses, and, you know, everybody's making money, and it's not good because now you're drafting poor guys and sending them out there into this damn meat grinder, using them as bait.
Yeah,
basically,
essentially.
To try to find the enemy, because the enemy really doesn't want to fight you. Like, this is the main problem of Vietnam was because it was being fought in a corporate fashion. There, no war was declared. They're just sending these guys into the middle of a civil war between Vietnamese. And then the Viet Cong was something that we kind of created years before to get rid of the French. It was just some...
Which they actually mentioned. If you see the Redux version, there's an extended scene in there where they go and there's these, you know, the French, you know, that they've been there for like a really long time.
Yeah.
They have a mansion and they have a whole discussion about that.
Yeah.
I think that's, the weird thing is that scene, it's probably the most, because some people are like, it kind of drags the plot down. It didn't need
to
be in there.
No, it gives the history of what the fuck is going on.
I think it kind of gives the history. I can understand how people say, oh, it drags the movie down and blah, blah, blah. But what they did was, it's not in the theatrical cut. The whole thing is in Redux, which is the longest version. And then in the final cut, which Francis Ford Coppola did for the 40th anniversary, which came out last year, like 2019, and like ran around in theaters and stuff. He actually left it in there, but he shortened it.
Yeah.
And he took out the Playboy Bunny, the second Playboy Bunny thing.
Yeah.
Scene as well.
I kind of liked that in there though. I thought
I
that
did
was,
too.
Because it was showing that it showed that everything was kind of corrupt, and it showed a different side to Willard. That Willard was a scoundrel.
Yeah.
You know, that he was, there was very much, Willard was very much kind of a figure of kind of dualism. And in the longer edit, when they're hanging out with the French colony, the conversation turns to politics and the history of Vietnam, and it turns out it's an opportunity to show the audience that Willard doesn't really know the history of the war. He's just fighting it.
Yeah.
Okay. He's just doing what he's told to do. Willard is like a perfect example of PTSD, I guess you could say. He's a complicated character. He's addicted to the war. He likes it. He's waiting for another mission because that's where he's getting his fix from. He's not rationalizing it until later on as the story, until he meets Kurtz. He's kind of figuring it all out. He's a good character. And he does a lot of stuff that, like, steals Kilgore's surfboard, which that got cut out of the theatrical release. And that was great. Kilgore sending the helicopters out. I will not harm you. Please, you just leave the board. It's just hilarious.
Well, and it just kind of showed where Kilgore's, like, priorities were.
Yeah. Well, what they're trying to do, what Milius is trying to do there, he's trying to humanize Kilgore in a way. Kilgore is a perfect war machine. He's just cut out for this shit. He loves it. All right. Mortars land around him. He doesn't even give a shit. He's taking care of his men. He's war daddy. You know, he's kind of like, what's his name from Fury Road? Kind of like,
I know what you're talking about.
What was that guy's name? Immortan Joe.
Yeah.
Okay. But he loves it. But it also turns out he's just a regular guy. He likes surfing too. And he's gonna surf the enemy's waves. That's a, you know, he's got his own surfboard. It's hard to get a surfboard there. And then Willard uses the fact that he's got a famous surfer with him to get Kilgore to take his boat to a certain location, to get him to a certain location. So it was kind of he's tempting the Cyclops, like you said.
Yeah.
And in the end, hey man, you better. He's going to make you surf, you know, because he's making his guys surf, you know, in the mortar fire, which is hilarious. And Willard steals his fucking surfboard just as a trophy.
Yeah.
To take what Kilgore
valued. I liked that scene. I liked that. Yeah. I know it's not in the theatrical cut, but...
It showed you that it added another dimension to Willard. Willard was fighting the war, and he felt he was at risk, but he was getting high off that risk.
Yeah.
He's seeing Kilgore, and he's just loving it. And Kilgore doesn't even see the risk. So, you know what I mean? Because there's no risk for Kilgore in Kilgore's mind.
Yeah.
He's going to fucking kind of emasculate him. I'm going to take his board. Yeah. I'm going to take his board. Because, you know, because that's the only thing he cared about. That was the only thing that he could threaten. So he threatened the board.
Yeah. Because he knew that was, like, the most important thing.
That was
like
his weakness. Yeah. Was the damn board. Because war wasn't his weakness.
Yeah, because he just totally did not even give a shit.
No.
Like you said, it's like mortar fire going by his arm, like right behind him. He didn't even flinch. He's whatever.
He's asking his boys, how you feeling? I'm feeling like a real killer, sir. Yeah.
I feel like a mean motherfucker.
It's all just great. Yeah, I feel like a mean motherfucker. Yeah, great. Yeah. So he actually, in case you guys don't know me, I'm fucking ex-airborne, ex-101st Airborne Division, 1st in the 506th and 1st in the 327th. So those air assault operations, they were calling them air mobile back then, but air assault operations, what I did, I was infantry, air assault infantry. So, no, when you go to war, that style of warfare, which is now actually obsolete, but in that style of warfare, Kilgore is who you want as your commander. That's who you want. You don't want any shrinking violet wallflower type commander. You want that, because that guy's probably more liable to get you home, because usually it's just... kind of like maximum aggression and maximum expertise. And, you know, he was doing his duties, getting evacuating his wounded. He had the priorities right, but it wasn't stressing him out at all. He was loving it.
Yeah, he was just having a great time.
One day this war's going to end. And then he went down. Oh, shit.
Bummer. Then what am I going to do?
Yeah, because that's where he belonged.
Yeah. And he's the one, obviously, probably the most famous line in the movie. I love the smell of napalm in the morning.
Yeah, it's like victory. But we didn't find a single body. Not one single. And that was actually typical for the theater. And then they try to, they call in, basically, all right, let me give you guys a background. Why Vietnam sucked for the infantry point of view and on the ground. They're telling you that you have to go out there and win this war. So you go out on patrol and you don't see anybody. Nothing happens. So who is the enemy? You're not sure. You know what I mean? It was civilians.
Yeah.
Nowadays you'd call it anti-terror, in a way. That's how they would label it, like anti-terrorist activity. So you had to get the enemy to shoot you. So you had to do things to get them to open up on you. And then one, but the thing is that you do that by going into their territories and just walking around waiting to be shot.
Yeah.
And then once you got shot, or what, some of your guys in your unit got shot, you then called in airstrikes on them. All right. Well, your chain of command for your Air Force and the Army is demanding results. How many people did you kill this week? Okay. So you go down in the bushes to see who got bombed, and you say, we think we found two. You know, according to the pieces, there may be two here. The guys in the jets going, okay, we killed them. And they go, no, we took casualties. We were on the ground. We killed them. So they were fighting over the kills. And they say, fuck it. Let's just say that we killed four and the planes killed four. So a total of eight were killed. And there was only enough pieces for two people. The rest of them got away.
Yeah.
So a lot of times when you looked, it was called by the numbers, doing things by the numbers. All right. And they were running it like a corporation. You had X amount of guys with X amount of ammunition, X amount of food, and X amount of people killed in X amount of time. And damn, you're not doing good. You're not going to get your promotion. So everyone was being pushed. Like they were running McDonald's.
Yeah.
McDonald's of death. How many burgers did you sell? You can't win a war that way. It's more artistic, and it's more, you have to find these people. It's social. You know what I mean? It was a social problem. It couldn't be solved. And Kurtz, when at the end, Kurtz reads him the Time magazine thing, right? Reads it to Willard. And it was all a bunch of lies about how effective the war was. The war wasn't effective at all. Nothing. They knew there was a certain amount of enemy out there, and they were claiming that they'd killed all these enemy, and that, oh, so we must be winning. No. Those numbers were all lies, because people had lied about how many people they killed. The casualty numbers, the official casualty numbers for enemy NVA or KIA and Viet Cong KIA, it was all lies. It was inflated probably about by eight times at least, because everybody had to divide it up.
Yeah.
You had to invent stuff to get credit. If not, your commanders wouldn't get promoted. So they'd help you lie. So that's what they were talking about, you know, with the bullshit piled up so high in Vietnam, you need wings to stay above it.
Well, like I said, I think that's what contributes to making this easily the best Vietnam movie, because it highlights the sort of madness and absurdity and all of the bullshit that was going on behind it. And it also kind of made a statement about like all these kind of poor people that were there, just kind of like you said, going into this meat grinder, these kids.
Yeah, yeah. And it was so somebody in Washington, D.C. or somebody in the Pentagon could buy a house. They're drafting these kids and putting them in this situation. And that report that Time magazine said in the movie, you know, Kurtz was talking about, that maybe, or I think it was the Time magazine thing, said that maybe they should shift into like fewer men of higher quality, which is eventually what it went to.
Yeah.
Because the problems in Vietnam were the same as the problems everywhere else. You couldn't fix these problems with tanks and helicopters and machine guns. That wouldn't do it. It had to be done at small scale, man to man, and it had to be the right people, you know what I mean, arresting or killing the right people. But what was funny is that the whole object of this fucking experiment in Vietnam, which is what it was not a war. No war was ever declared. The problem with it was that the American machine never had any intention of winning it in quotes. Never. It was just to try out new weaponry, to get your army trained up, and to career advancement. That was really what they did it for.
Yeah.
Ridiculous.
Yeah.
But the way they thought back then was very different. They're like, well, we'll figure out which weapons actually work and what kind of men work and how to run an army in there. We'll use this as a big training field. And then I'll get a new house and I'll get all these contracts and make money. I'll get reelected. That was what they were thinking.
Do you know that?
Never had anything to do with solving Vietnam's problems or anything. They didn't care about that.
Yeah, of course not.
No.
I mean, did you know that for this movie... They actually approached, obviously, the U.S. Army and was like, hey, can we borrow your shit for the movie?
They probably went, hell.
And Donald Rumsfeld was like, no, because the movie's anti-Vietnam, yeah, so we're not going to let you use our shit.
Yeah.
So they ended up having to go to fucking Ferdinand Marcos in the Philippines, because that's mostly where they shot this.
Okay.
And they just had to, they said it was, like, fucking crazy, because I want to get a little bit into the, like, the production of this, because, like I said, it was fucking crazy, and how such a masterpiece came out of this clusterfuck is just, like, a miracle for the ages.
Yeah.
But so they had to borrow helicopters and shit from the from the Filipinos, and they had to, like, repaint them with American shit. Yeah. And then sometimes they'd be filming in the day, and then Ferdinand Marcos would be like, hey, I need my helicopters back because we got, like, some insurrection shit going on over here. And it's like sometimes they didn't even have time to, like, repaint the shit, so they still had, like, American stars on them and shit like that. Yeah. And they had to go. It was just, like, a ridiculous situation.
The higher meaning of the movie in terms of an anti-Vietnam thing, if that's the way you wanted to interpret it, which it was, okay. I wouldn't say it was anti-war in general, just kind of an anti-Vietnam. Anti-Vietnam. It's anti-Vietnam because the style of warfare that was being used in the movie and also in Vietnam was already obsolete by the time all this shit's happening. It didn't work. It didn't work.
And
then,
it's just
it
all those people died for nothing.
Yeah, it didn't work. It couldn't work.
Yeah.
Kurtz's way of doing it would have worked, was the tribal way. It was working. And part of the reason why they wanted Kurtz dead is because Kurtz could have exposed the scam. And they didn't believe that war should be savage. It should, like, a savage tribal conflict. But that's what it was anyway. Kurt was just getting to the heart of the matter, the heart of darkness. It was just a savage tribal war.
Yeah, like trying people. Yeah, savages. Like it was almost kind of like his conflict was, you know, with the higher ups, trying to make it seem like they're almost trying to, like, sanitize.
They're trying to make it seem civilized.
And try to make it seem civilized, which
is not what it was. Yeah.
But so, okay, so very famously, like I said, so Milius wrote the screenplay, and it took, like, a long time. Originally, I don't know if you guys know this, but George Lucas was supposed to direct this shit. But it ended up taking so long, and George Lucas went off to do Star Wars famously, so he didn't really do it. What's that?
No. George Lucas's friendship with John Milius resulted in the Star Wars that you know.
Yeah.
All the stuff about the Force, the light side and the dark side and everything. That's all the influence of John Milius's kind of Eastern/Germanic philosophies that he was into, which that's what made that Star Wars work. So you can kind of credit Milius for the success of the idea of Star Wars.
Well, the thing about John Milius was he is really into, like, these kind of mythic
tales. Mythics.
Like I said, so, you know, like the Odyssey or
Joseph Campbell,
you know,
stuff.
Joseph Campbell's, like, yeah, the Golden Bough, the Fisher King, like, all that kind of stuff. So he's very into the, like, these very mythical stories that have been around for thousands and thousands of years in different iterations. So I think that's the reason why a lot of his stuff works so well, because it has, it has that kind of mythical underpinning to it, which this does as well. So, all right. So that had kind of been going around. Like I said, George Lucas was supposed to direct it. And then all that ended up happening. And then Francis Ford Coppola decided to do it. Now, initially, the shoot for this was only supposed to take, I believe, 5 months. They were, like I said, they were going to shoot it in the Philippines. Very famously, because of all of these horrible things that happened, this ended up taking more than a year to shoot. They had problems like a fucking typhoon came through and blew away all the sets, including the one that all the Playboy bunnies were dancing on, and they had to rebuild the whole thing. That was like 8 weeks or something like that, that they were set back with that. So the character of Willard was actually offered to several actors. I think the first choice was Steve McQueen, but he said no because he's like, I don't want to be out of the country that long.
So a lot of people, like George Lucas, he made all that money
American Graffiti.
American Graffiti. He made all that money and got rich, and he's like, I don't want to go to the Philippines. Too many bugs.
Yeah,
rains all the time.
Yeah, I think that kind of happened with a lot of, I mean, even back then, like, you know, the shoot was only supposed to be, you know, 14 weeks or whatever it was supposed to be to start with. So I guess all those people were kind of vindicated after, like, the fucking shoot took so much longer and, like, went way over budget, and it was, like, a huge nightmare.
It was worth it, though.
But, yeah, well, happily. But, yeah, so Steve McQueen was the first choice. Several other actors were asked, and they mostly turned it down for the same reason. Now, the guy that was originally supposed to play Willard was Harvey Keitel.
Yeah.
And he actually did, I think he was there for 2 or 3 weeks shooting. And what ended up happening was that Francis Ford Coppola, he wanted the character of Willard to be kind of like a passive observer. And he said that Harvey Keitel couldn't really play that. He seemed like he was too, I don't know. It's like he was just too intense. He was too, so it's kind of like, so he kind of kicked him off the shoot, and then they ended up getting Martin Sheen. Now, interestingly, I saw something about this earlier today, that the opening scene with Martin Sheen in the hotel room, and he's just like losing his shit, like doing all the weird dancing and like punching the mirror and everything, you know, because he's kind of finding his own heart of darkness, I suppose. So basically what they did, they're like, we shot that on Martin Sheen's birthday. And he's like, well, I'm going to get drunk. And they said, yeah, get fucked up.
Yeah.
So when you see that shit, he's completely shit-faced. He actually did punch the mirror and broke his hand. They tried to stop it, and he said, no, I got to keep going. So he was just, like, working through some shit, like, in that. So he is completely, that is, like, not even acting.
Yeah.
And also very famously, as the shoot went on, everybody was, like, I think Francis Ford Coppola lost, like, 40 pounds or something because it was a lot of his own money on the line. He couldn't get enough money to do what he wanted to do. So he basically put his house and his winery and I think one of his car, like some of his cars and shit like that, he gave them to Chase Bank for collateral and was basically like, you know, I need, you know, $30 million more dollars. I need this, that, and the other thing. So it's like, if this movie was not a success, he was ruined.
Yeah.
He wouldn't have a house. His winery would be, everything would be gone. He'd be fucking broke. So that was very stressful. A lot of people said, yeah, he threatened to kill himself like at least 3 times on the fucking set. He lost all this weight. Martin Sheen had a near fatal heart attack, even though he was only 36 years old, just from the fucking stress of all of the shit that was going on. And like I said, the movie was almost kind of like they had John Milius' script, but Francis Ford Coppola kind of had his own thing, like what he wanted to do with it too. So he didn't really, I don't even think he had an end. You know what I mean? They shot, I think it was something like 1.5 million feet of footage or something like that. They just shot like fucking an unbelievable amount of footage that they shot. And it ended up taking 4 people and 2 years to edit it into some kind of coherent form. And even when they first showed it, I think they first showed it at the Cannes Film Festival, and it wasn't even done. It was like a 3-hour cut. And I think that Francis Ford Coppola, I mean, at least according to Milius, like an interview that I read with him, he said Francis Ford Coppola the whole time thought he was making a piece of shit. And he thought that it was just going to, like,
it's one of the best movies
financially
ever.
Ruin him. But yeah.
And having been in a bunch of air assaults, I'm telling you, that the air assault scene, that looked real to me. I think that really did look like the interiors of UH-1s, Hueys, and Little Birds flying around. I mean, that's the way it felt. It looked like those camera shots were taken from inside flying choppers.
I don't really get any sense of anything being fucking fake. Like all of the shit in this. Now some of this stuff that's real, like when they kill that caribou or whatever it is at the end, that is real.
I thought it was just a water buffalo.
I think it's a water buffalo. Yeah, you're right.
That was some kind of tribal thing though. Ceremony. They ate that. So.
Yeah, and that's how they got around.
It's just a halal slaughter, I guess.
That's how they got around the animal cruelty laws because they said, well, you know, that was the tribal. They eat it afterward, and it's like that's what they would have done. So they just like filmed it for the movie.
Let me talk about some of let me talk about Willard.
Okay.
All right. I heard some people saying that Willard was fucking special forces in the movie. And I kind of thought that at first, the first couple times that I saw it, because he's wearing tiger stripe. And that was uniforms that were pretty much issued to special forces. But if you look at his uniform, he's actually 173rd Airborne, and he's an Airborne Ranger. He just happens, that's it, that was his combat patch was 173rd. But he was working for MAC VSOG, which was like a combined special operations group made up of all branches of the U.S. military, all branches of the South Vietnam military, and the intelligence agencies. So it was kind of like a combined high talent rock group, in a way, of military units. So he wasn't Special Forces. He didn't have an SF tab. And in one of the deleted scenes, or a part of the deleted scenes where he's accepting the mission from the general to go out and kill Kurtz, the general asks him what he thinks of Special Forces. And he says, I've worked with them. They're pretty good. He says, they're good. And then the guy kind of looks a little uneasy. And the reason why he's asking that was cut out. The reason why he's asking that is because he's asking him to kill a Special Forces colonel.
Yeah.
So he doesn't want to send a guy on the mission that is kind of idolizes anything Special Forces. And then some meaningful glances are happening between the general and this CIA guy. And it has to do with this, what do you think of Special Forces? And they're kind of unspoken. The unspoken thing is that the Army brass is not trusting Special Forces. That they're kind of, I guess, going native. That's what it seems to be that they're worried about. At this time, Special Forces was kind of a newish thing, you know. It was, I guess, one of their first wars. It had come out of a World War II group. MACSOG was kind of like the OSS, I guess you could say. And they did things that could have been illegal, like assassinate people on your own side because you found out they were double dealing, but you don't want that information out, so you just kill them. That kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And it's civilians, killing civilians. Maybe friendly civilians that are double dealing with the enemy. So there has to be a way of taking care of these problems. It used to be OSS. What ended up happening in Vietnam is that some of it was MACVSOG was doing kind of what OSS did. But Special Forces was running a lot of basically kind of like long-range reconnaissance patrol stuff that involved ambushes and training ARVN troops, which are South Vietnamese troops. They were making South Vietnamese Rangers and shit. And in this context of this story, they're kind of showing you that the U.S. Army might be kind of not trusting these Special Forces guys, that they're out there too deep in the jungle for too long, that they're finding out too much, and they're going rogue. In fact, in Kurtz's files, it shows that he did a rogue operation that was very successful, and had the news not found out about it, they would have busted his ass down. But the news found out about it first, so the Army had to approve this unapproved operation that he did that resulted in wiping out a bunch of enemy people. Remember that?
Yeah.
He was reading that in the file. So they're telling you in the story that Special Forces wasn't being real trusted because they were kind of finding out how to win a war, and the Pentagon really had no intents of winning the war, especially the way they wanted to do it, because their way was a little too efficient, and they would have missed out on all that contract money. So there's a bunch of different ways that you can look into that.
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit about how the end of this movie is very similar to the end of Conan?
Yes,
it's pretty much the same ending. Yeah. Now, interestingly, I think there have been rumors going around that it has five different endings. It doesn't really. I think that basically Coppola, he couldn't decide, like when they were shooting it, he didn't really have an ending in mind. He's basically like, it's either going to end the way that it ends, which is that Willard goes, he kills Kurtz, he essentially takes over his role, like, you know, from Conrad's point of view, he takes the Heart of Darkness. But then he kind of goes down and takes Lance, who is the only remaining member of the team, and kind of leads him back to the thing, and they don't do the airstrike. He's like, so we're either going to end it like that, or we're going to do the airstrike, where they called in the airstrike, which was, the code word was Almighty, and just wipes everybody out in Kurtz's compound. So what was interesting, though, was that, and I didn't actually notice this when we were watching it, because we watched the Redux version. I've seen the theatrical version a long time ago, and we watched the Redux version for this. What is interesting is that, one, this movie does not have credits when they, I mean, that's how Coppola wanted it. And he's like, basically, when it first kind of made the rounds, he had it almost like a theater program where he had like the whole cast and crew like printed out like on a thing that they would give to you so he wouldn't have to put credits in there. But then later they were like, no, you kind of need to put some credits on there. So he put the credits on the end, but he put the credits over footage of one of the napalm strikes just because he liked the footage. But then he realized that people thought that the napalm strike was the airstrike coming and wiping out Kurtz's compound. And he's like, and that's not how I wanted the movie to end. People were like misinterpreting. He's like, I just thought the footage was cool. And I just put the credits like over that. But everybody thought, oh shit, they blew everything up. But that's not how the movie was supposed to end. The movie was supposed to end essentially by, you know, as you said, it was kind of like, Milius even said, it's kind of like the Fisher King story where Willard comes, he kills the king, Kurtz, and, you know, takes his shit or takes over his power, takes over the Heart of Darkness, as Conrad would say. Everybody in Kurtz's thing kind of bows down to him, but he essentially doesn't want it.
Yeah. It's the same thing as in Conan.
Yeah.
All right. Conan cuts off Thulsa Doom's head with his father's broken sword. All right, after he's figured out the fucking riddle of steel and the meaning of the riddle of steel. The cult members all kneel to him because in more ancient primitive societies, if you killed the king, you became the king.
Yeah, that's
Might
what, yeah.
made right.
Yeah.
Okay. So he killed Thulsa Doom, proving that he was more powerful than Thulsa Doom. All the cult members kneel. Evidently, they lose their faith. He dismisses them. They all walk off. He goes down to the end of the fucking temple and sits there like Nietzsche's the thinker and thinks about Thulsa Doom's power and decides not to accept that power, that he's going to take a different path. He goes beyond it.
Yeah. Okay?
Beyond the temptation. And then he takes the princess that he was hired to rescue, takes her by the hand, and they walk off together. You know, she was waiting for him to make the decision to maybe become the new lord. And they're kind of a male and female opposites, but they're kind of recognizing that they're kind of a part of the same system, yin and yang, you know, male and female. It was, you know, the warrior and kind of like innocence, I guess you could say. Well, that's redone again in Apocalypse Now. All right. Willard says, I'm gonna complete the mission. Cuts off Kurtz's head. Kurtz's army, being, you know, basically tribal and primal warriors, recognize that as a legitimate act of secession. They look to him for the leadership. He turns it down and he takes Lance, the surfer.
Yeah.
All right.
Who was the only guy left alive?
Only guy. He takes him. And they walk off
by together. And don't call in the airstrike.
Nope, they didn't. Now, you say, well, wait a minute, hold on. Why the guy? Why Lance? If you had been paying attention to the story, Lance was a surfer who really didn't belong in Vietnam. He had just been drafted. And through the whole thing, he did fight back, but through the whole thing, he just kind of looked at the war through, like, the eyes of just wonder and innocence.
Yeah,
he'd just stand up in the middle of the damn gunfight because he was on acid watching it, going, wow. He recognized when people were playing with him, like when they were going down in the patrol boat and the natives shot toy arrows at him. He just played back and put the arrows. He didn't shoot back at them. Everybody else did.
Yeah.
So he was kind of lighthearted and playful and innocent about the whole thing. And it didn't seem to affect him in the same way as it affected
And he was the guy that found the puppy as well.
And he wanted to go back for the puppy. It didn't, he was able to kind of stay above it and kind of maintain his innocence in a way. It was kind of like sending a child to combat.
Yeah, he did come across as very childlike.
Yeah,
And I think that, and I think that you're right. He was kind of like the...
He was the stand-in for a female.
The representation of, or just innocence.
Innocence, you know, I think, more than anything else. Innocence, and he it was somebody who didn't belong there, didn't really deserve to be there in terms of, they hadn't done anything wrong.
Yeah.
They were just kind of, they were drafted, they were forced to go.
Yeah.
And remember, he spent a lot of time just amazed by it.
Yeah, and he was real high most of the time as well.
Right, but that was part of it, though. I mean, he didn't take it seriously. He stayed high through the whole thing, going, wow.
Yeah.
Wow, this is a trip.
Yeah, because this is a very, very trippy movie. This is one that I really, really wish that I had seen on the big screen. Actually, if I had known that they had done, like, the version last year, back in 2019, where they re-released it to theaters, I would have gone. Because I've never got to see this on the big screen, and it must really be something else.
Yeah.
Because the imagery of it is just amazing, and it's been remastered and shit like that, too.
Now, when they got to the camp, they killed Chef, because Chef said, yeah, I'll call in the airstrike. I'll kill him myself. I'll kill him. He was into it.
Kurt's cut his head off.
Kurt's cut his head off. But they didn't even hurt Lance, because Lance just walked around like an innocent child.
Yeah.
Wow. Because, look at that place. Wow. It's like he wasn't there. It was like he was watching something.
Well,
so they didn't see him as a threat.
And he just kind of, like, went along with whatever.
It. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I think a lot of draftees going through Vietnam would kind of like that. Just kind of riding along with it. Remember, there was a lot of veterans that were inspiring Milius and telling him stories. So,
yeah.
And I think these guys were based on stories that he had heard.
He said that the story that Colonel Kurtz tells about the about them coming and, like, cutting off the kids' arms, like when they got vaccinated or whatever. Milius said that he had a friend that was in Vietnam that had either done that or had seen it.
Yeah.
But nobody knows if it really did happen or not, because it was kind of an urban legend that went around.
There's a lot of legendary stories that came out of Vietnam. A lot of dudes lied about Vietnam. You had serial killers lying. Yeah, I was in Vietnam in a special forces unit and I just killed women.
Yeah.
And it turns out that dude was never in fucking service. You know, there's so much mythologizing
about it.
My first sergeant Richardson did two tours of Vietnam and went up and down Hamburger Hill, I think, two or three times in a 24-hour period. And in his wallet had whole pictures of his whole platoon dead on the damn flight line. It was him and like five other guys in his platoon that lived. And we had squad leaders in my time that were Vietnam veterans. And they told us that the ship was run very tightly. It wasn't like a bunch of ragbags and being wild men. They were under quite a bit of control. Yeah, bad shit happened every now and then. But all in all, the discipline levels were pretty high. Which, that's not what you're really showing. They didn't want to be high, but they were. They were fucking, discipline was pretty brutal most of the time. Now, there may have been some places where, unit cohesion broke down. Like, how they showed the one unit where the commander stepped on a landmine and a replacement never came, so everything was just going to shit?
Yeah.
That wouldn't happen in real life. The commander would be killed, somebody else would take over immediately, and they would send a new commander. And
yeah.
The army was being... The war was being fought through a system of what was called fire bases, and they were tightly controlled. And they looked great. They looked real organized and ship-shape, There were little artillery fire bases, and they were running patrols out of them, and they had little landing zones for choppers and shit, and they had all the amenities. And
but like I said, I think that using the lens of Vietnam to tell this story through,
they're trying to make it more savage.
Not so much realistic as mythic. I mean, he wanted it to be
spiritually correct.
Yeah, he wanted it to be kind of like I said, a descent into the underworld. So it's just like the farther you went up the river,
the worse it got.
The more madness, the more savagery, the more, so every single stop they made, it just got worse and worse and worse. And that was just kind of how, and the book is kind of like that too.
Now, there's some more Conan references and Conan lessons in there too that I don't know if you picked it up. What's his name? Chief Phillips, the guy who ran the boat.
Yeah,
he kind of had a special bond with Clean.
Yeah, played by a very, very young Lawrence Fishburne.
Yeah, you don't even recognize
so
him.
Young.
So
I didn't even recognize him Fishburne. Because he was like he was a kid.
And Clean was a great character. Real. There was a lot of guys in service that when I was in there were like clean, you know, real young, and looking to his commander for guidance and support, you know, for safety. There was definitely a father-son type relationship going on between those two. And then when Clean got fucking waxed, Phillips fucking lost it. And what ends up happening later on is kind of an explanation of why Phillips tried to kill Kurtz in the very end. It's because Phillips was really trying to do his duty. He was trying to protect his crew. He was blaming all this on Willard. He was forced to go on this mission with Willard. And Willard really didn't know where they were going. He had to find Kurtz.
Yeah.
So, in his dying moments, Chief Phillips says, well, if I'm going to die, I can kill Willard, and it'll save the crew because they'll just turn back and go home.
Yeah.
And that's why he was doing
that. Yeah, because he got hit by the arrow, and he tried to pull Willard down
into the arrow.
Onto the arrow.
And that was his attempt at trying to save the crew.
Yeah. Well, because, yeah, he got totally, like, fucking, they didn't want to fucking go on that mission.
No,
they got roped into it, and they didn't really know where they were going.
And essentially,
they were going into Cambodia, which they weren't really supposed to be doing.
Yeah, there was no war in Cambodia.
Right.
That was part of the thing where there wasn't a war in Vietnam either. It was a police action. No war was ever declared. They're fighting with limited numbers, this UN-sanctioned police action / forever war. Most of the enemy, for safety, just went up into damn Laos and Cambodia to hide because you couldn't attack them there.
Right.
So they were safe there. They did jump the border. Well, that's where all the good shit was happening, and evidently that's where Kurtz decided that's where he was going to strike, because that's where the enemy was.
Yeah.
You know? And he was using tribal tactics against them, which were working. But that's not the situation the army wanted. But Kurtz didn't care what the army wanted. He gave up his career as a general to join the special forces, which meant that he would never get above colonel. He didn't want to be a general. Kurtz was not in it for career. He was in it because he wanted to be a warrior.
Yeah.
And he got what he wanted. He found out.
Yeah.
Found the heart of darkness.
He definitely
did. He didn't care if he lived or died, and Willard took him out. He was a modified version of Thulsa Doom. The difference was that Thulsa Doom ended up maturing into a warrior that used his words and manipulation and subversion to get people to obey him through, you know, the power of flesh.
Yeah.
You know, is what he called it. Kurtz was like that, except he used, I guess, the power of direct action and unconventional warfare.
Well, you know, having heads and bodies all over your
terror,
shit. Yeah.
You know,
he was just,
because that's
fear.
What works.
Yeah, to control everyone.
Yep.
But yeah, so, and I forgot to mention too, and this is also a very famous story about Apocalypse Now, was that when Marlon Brando arrived to do his scenes, he was also kind of bitching about, because I think he got paid $2 or $3 million for this movie. Mm-hmm. And he arrived like a lot later because he didn't have to shoot his scenes until later. And in the book, I don't know if you know, but Kurtz is like a real, real scrawny dude.
He was kind of scrawny in the movie.
He doesn't get... No,
oh, no,
Kurtz.
I was thinking Willard.
I was going to say, he's definitely not scrawny.
Yeah, Kurtz. Yeah, well, he got a little fat, didn't he?
Yeah. Well, yeah, the thing about it, and another thing too, is at the end of the book, nobody kills Kurtz. He dies of a disease.
Probably what, malaria or something.
But, yeah, I think it was malaria. But, yeah, so Marlon Brando shows up, and he's like 300 pounds.
Yeah.
And Francis Ford Coppola is, like, flipping out. He's like, look, your costume doesn't fit now.
Yeah.
It's like, what the fuck, dude? Yeah. I thought you were supposed to be, like, a special forces lean and hungry type of... That's what he kind of hired him for.
Right.
And then he shows up, and he's this, like, big, fat person.
I understand what happened. You know what happened to Brando, right? I've seen the photographs. Brando got jacked.
Yeah.
I mean, he looked fucking great in the years before this, which tells me he was on anabolic steroids. And then when he came off those things, man, he had a tremendous hormone crash.
Yeah.
Which you will get fat as fuck.
Which he did.
Because your testosterone production shuts down. They didn't know back then that you need to jump on Clomid to get that T levels back up. And I don't think they knew much about hormone fucking therapy and replacement, but they would just jump on steroids and then just jump off like you could do that.
Yeah.
No, you'll get fat. For real, for real fat.
Which he did.
That's what happened.
And like I said, so he showed up, yeah. And it's he was completely not prepared. He hadn't read the script. I think they had to shut down for 9 days so Coppola could read the script to him, because he couldn't even be bothered to read it himself. And he just kept arguing about what the character was going to be like and blah, 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 until finally he read the original book one night, and then he was like, okay, well, I'll play the character like that, like the one in the book. Also very famously, him and Dennis Hopper didn't get along. They actually hated each other, and so they were kind of, they couldn't even if they were in the same scene, they couldn't even like be in the same, they had to shoot him at different times and like do it because they hated each other so much.
But the thing is, I kind of understand the fat Colonel Kurtz.
Yeah.
Because in the context of this story, he was really no longer a special forces commander. Yeah. He was now basically a tribal warlord.
Yeah.
Which he would have been sitting around thinking philosophy, and they've been feeding him and overfeeding him.
Yeah, it actually ended up working out.
It makes
out
a little
well.
More sense.
And then the way that they...
King. He became a king.
And then the way that Francis Ford Coppola ended up shooting him, like mostly in shadow, just mostly his face and things like that. I think they did have a body double for some of the long shots so he wouldn't look quite so big, like wearing him, you know, putting him in black clothes and stuff. I think it actually turned out for the better, because he comes across like a mythological figure almost, because you can't really see him. And then like all the stuff that he's saying, like all this, like quoting T.S. Eliot and like all that kind of stuff.
Well, he was also saying all kinds of stuff that was relevant, that if you kind of understood the way armies are and what was happening in Vietnam. So his recordings and the messages that he was sending out. Remember the general's plane? He said, look, this is the transmission we got from him. And he goes, I watched a slug crawl across the edge of a straight razor.
Yeah.
It sounds fucking crazy, but it makes perfect sense. So he's talking about the United States Army and its armed forces crawling across the straight razor of Vietnam being cut and destroyed. It's because it was a big, slow, ungainly thing that required a total... It could not do what it was supposed to do. It required pinpoint targeting of specific people. All right? And lots of terror. It had to be something tribal and personal against certain people. That was the only way you were going to win, unquote, Vietnam. But there was no way to win Vietnam. It was a social problem. You cannot solve that with military force. If you really looked at what the problem was, it was landlords charging too high of a rent on rice farmers. That's really what it was about. And it had the trappings of communism, and that's what the people back in the United States were told. We're stopping the spread of communism. Now, Ho Chi Minh didn't give a shit about communism. He went to us first to ask us for support to help them get the French out of there.
Yeah.
So he wanted to ally with us. But he allied with the only people that offered him any support, and it was China and a little bit Russia. And they hated the Chinese, and that was talked about in that damn...
In the scene, with the French.
Yeah, and they never really became communist, per se. They just kind of had the superficial trappings of it. So that was just more of what Willard was saying about the bullshit would pile up so high in Vietnam, you needed wings to stay above it. Yeah. It was mostly bullshit.
Yeah.
On both sides, all sides.
And like I said, that's why this is probably the best. I don't think there'll be a better Vietnam movie made, just because this really captured, like you said, it captured the spiritual essence of the whole enterprise.
And we were in there supporting the guys that supposedly should have been the good guys, which were kind of the more Western style with Christian influenced and capitalist inspired, that these were the guys we really should have been supporting. That was a corrupt ass regime, really bad to its people. So we were kind of fighting on the wrong side of the war just based on the very shallow appearances of capitalism and communism. But it gets back to the thing, the military-industrial complex or the big Washington, D.C. machine really didn't give a shit about that place. It was just a project. It was a means of advancing their careers. They didn't care about it. Their heart wasn't in it. And the movie says that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like I said, it really kind of perfectly encapsulates not only a period in time, but like I said, I think that's why Apocalypse Now is still considered one of the best movies ever made. Not just the best war movies ever made, one of the best movies ever made, period.
Yeah.
You know, it got nominated for, like, the fucking Academy Awards. It got, like, it's topped the list. I think the, what's that big list that's in the UK? Like, best movies ever. It's, like, the top of that one. And it's just kind of like, and honestly, all three versions are good, because I was watching something the other day and people were like, you know, if I've never seen it, which version should I watch? Because all three of them are different. But, and you know, there's arguments to be made that any of the three versions are good. But I don't know. I just feel like I like Redux because it's everything is in there. You know what I mean? And I totally get why some people would not like it, you know, just because not like it as much as the theatrical cut. Because I've seen some people say, oh, they like the theatrical cut better because it's like the pacing's better or whatever. But I don't know. I kind of like to see the longer version with everything in it.
Yeah, they're both good.
Yeah, and like I said, the final cut is essentially Redux, but with 20 minutes taken out. I think they take out the second bunny scene. They take out some of the French stuff, but not all of it.
Yeah.
You know, they shorten that scene up some.
Some people have asked, what's the meaning of the movie? The meaning of this movie is the same as the meaning of Conan, which is that which does not kill you makes you stronger. That's the one of the messages. The other message is that you're kind of basically on a quest to go what Nietzsche would kind of call beyond good and evil. What that means is that giving up on very superficial value judgments of what happens in order to what is happening in the world in order to find what the truth is. In other words, get rid of labels. Those were the two main themes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, like you said, was similar
to Conan.
So you can almost watch these two movies kind of like...
both masterpieces.
Next to each other.
If you like this movie, watch Conan 1. Don't worry about 2 too much. It's not Milius. It's more of a kid's movie. It's not a bad movie. It's just not a great movie. This one, Conan 1, and Jeremiah Johnson, and Red Dawn. Similar.
Yeah.
Similar. Milius was not a typical dude, not typical Hollywood, especially for the time. Okay. At this time in California, Hollywood was a very California, UCLA, Berkeley film school. Very California, young Jewish guy, very Democrat left kind of leaning. And Milius was that too, but not left, more right. He was very contrary. If you told him right, he would say left. He did not like to go along with it, which did not make him a lot of friends in Hollywood. The other Jewish guys were kind of like, what's this dude? What is he, a fascist? I mean, was he a Nazi? Why does he like Nietzsche? That's German stuff. No, it's just, listen to Milius. There's a lot of, he was a cool dude. I liked him.
He's an interesting character.
Very interesting guy. And he was Jewish in the Ariel Sharon way, the very right wing, but not political. It was more spiritual. It was about growth and overcoming things, and he liked the struggle, and that's how he thought.
Well, almost kind of like you had to find, like, go down into like the most darkest part of yourself too.
He would go on long camping trips and hunting trips and stuff up in, I think, Oregon and stuff, and Colorado.
Yeah, because he lived out in the wilderness. Yeah.
Yeah, because he couldn't go to the military, so the next best thing was to go on these hunting expeditions, living outdoors for a long time, so you can suffer.
Yeah.
Because it's not easy, it's hard. And that's what makes you stronger. So, I love everything about Milius. I totally know what he's talking about, and I can back up most of what he believes in is spiritually true. Maybe not factually, but spiritually it's true.
Yeah.
It's one way of doing things. It's the way I prefer to do things.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it really, like, that...
it's about preference, I think.
His stuff really does resonate with you particularly. Yeah. But like I said, Apocalypse Now, I never heard anybody say anything bad about this movie, to be honest. The reviews were a little bit mixed when it first came out, but...
Hollywood guys didn't like it, evidently.
But,
and then
what ended up happening was that they were kind of like, most people, you know, like Roger Ebert, people like that, was like, it's a fucking masterpiece. There were a couple that were kind of like mixed reviews, but then, I mean, only like a year later, people were just like, yeah, it's a classic. So it didn't really take a really long time before people recognized
that it was
a work of genius.
You can't hide genius. You can't hide greatness. It starts to rise to the top, especially over time.
Yeah.
Yeah. maybe people don't like it when it's released, but that shit's not going to go anywhere if it's great. Over time, people...
Yeah, it took a lot, because we talk a lot about movies that, you know, like The Shining or The Thing or something like that, that, didn't get real great reviews at the time, but then it took a while and it found its audience. This one, mostly same thing, although, like I said, most critics recognized that it was genius from the start.
Yeah.
There were a few mixed reviews, but it really seemed like the mixed reviews just kind of went out the window like a year or two later. Everybody recognized.
It's the same with a lot of the Dino De Laurentiis movies like Flash Gordon, Dune.
Yeah.
They, at the time that they came out, you know, they actually, Conan 1, I think, was Dino De Laurentiis. Conan 2 was also, even though they were different directors. But when Dune 1 came out, it kind of flopped. But in a way, there's a lot of greatness to that movie, even though it's very imperfect. I mean, they're trying to tell a 3-movie story in one movie. And it's kind of moving a little faster.
I mean, we talked about that on the Dune movie, that it just seemed like an impossible...
Still visually and just the score and just there's something kind of religious about it. It's almost like something out of the Old Testament.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that movie still. We'll see what the remake's like. They say, so far I've heard that the first part of the remake is pretty good.
I'm excited about it.
Yeah. But, you can't go wrong with this one. This is a good movie.
Yeah, and I feel like this is a movie that probably everybody that's into film should see it.
Yeah.
I mean, because this is...
Yeah.
But this is pure filmmaking right
here. Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's just an amazing, amazing film.
Yeah. Now, here's another thing we're talking about, Milius. Wasn't that The Big Lebowski? His friend was based upon John Milius.
Yeah.
In the movie The Big Lebowski. He's got a Vietnam veteran friend played by, what's that guy's name? He's fucking.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, they modeled that character after Milius.
Yeah.
And if you see interviews with Milius, you can see exactly what they're talking about.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a good flick. Good flick.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great flick. Yeah. Like I said, everybody should see it. And if you haven't seen it, go see it right now. I mean, it's like seeped into the cultural consciousness, man. Yeah. It's like all the fucking shit about Charlie Don't Surf and fucking... So there's so many lines from this that are like so iconic. So many lines, so many situations. It's been like so parodied and everything like that. So I feel like if you haven't seen it, you really, really should. But yeah, so that will do it for this extra long movie retrospective.
Yeah.
And we'll see you on the next one. Bye.